morning and welcome to Cool
Science Radio, science and technology that's accessible, educational, and fun. I'm John Wells. I'm here with Lynn Ware Peake. Our first guest this morning, Park City resident Chris Fisher. You may remember Chris as the host of the four-time Emmy Award-winning Offshore Adventures, a television series chronicling a life at sea, fishing, free diving, conservation. More recently, Chris founded and is chairman and expedition leader for OSearch. Fisher's company is recognized worldwide, generating critical scientific data related to tracking and studying keystone marine species such as the great white and tiger sharks. We look forward to having Chris back on the program.
That's right. Good morning, John. I'm Lynn Ware Peake. Our second guest this morning is Dr. Mitch Goldberg. He's the chief scientist for NOAA's Joint Polar Satellite System. NOAA, of course, stands for the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. The Joint Polar Satellite System set is the first in a new series of four highly advanced National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration polar orbiting satellites. Now, it's scheduled to launch on Tuesday, next Tuesday, November 14th, from Vandenberg Air Force Base in California. This satellite system represents a significant technological and scientific advancement in observations used for severe weather prediction and environmental monitoring.
Also, I wanted to mention that the 2017 hurricane season will be over on November 30th, according to humans. We'll see if Mother Nature wants to abide by that schedule. And I wanted to mention on December 14th on Cool Science Radio, Dr. Scott Braun from Goddard Space Flight will be with us to talk about what GPM, the Global Precipitation Measurement Satellite, has learned from their CAT scans of the hurricanes that have hit so hard this season. So make sure you tune in. Those two guests plus today's cool story when we return. You're listening to Cool Science Radio. Stay with us.
Beth here, owner of Peak Art and Frame, longtime supporters of KPCW. At Peak Art and Frame, we carry a wide variety of framing options, and our design staff can help with any project for your home, office, or gallery. Open Monday through Saturday and located in the Walmart Shopping Center, 649-0801 or peakartandframe.com.
Earl Foote here with Nexus IT, happy to keep KPCW Radio and their staff running smoothly. We provide sales and maintenance on all computer systems and can guide our customers about cloud solutions for their businesses or personal computer needs. More info available at 435-487-9099 or nexusitc.net.
And welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm John Wells. I'm here with Lynn Ware Peake. Our first guest this morning, Chris Fisher, founder, chairman, expedition leader for OSearch. OSearch has just completed their 30th expedition. OSearch tracks and studies the movement of tagged white, great white, and tiger sharks. They share all this data real time with anybody that has a smartphone. It downloads a free shark tracker app. OSearch also provides K-8 courseware at no cost that enables students to learn STEM skills while following the movements of their favorite sharks. Chris Fisher, welcome back.
Thanks
to Cool Science Radio.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Oh, great to have you back. And I wanted to ask you about one of the sharks that I track. You know, you and I have a couple things in common. One of them is that we have moms that are Southern who are named Mary Lee. So when you tagged the 4,000-pound female off of the coast of New York, I was interested and I started tracking her. And she's been all over the place, very active, but we have not seen a ping since the middle of June. I wanted to ask, is she okay?
Yeah, sure. Well, we believe Mary Lee is okay. We tagged Mary Lee in 2012 off of Cape Cod, Massachusetts. Certainly the most legendary and historic fish we've ever been a part of, the most famous real great white shark in history. Those tags last about 5 years, and we're about 5 years and a few months past her tagging date. So I think it's unlikely we'll hear a whole bunch more from Mary Lee. We might get the odd ping here and there. We have had sharks ping in as long as 8 years. But Mary Lee has already done so much, it feels like it's difficult to ask any more from her. She completely shifted the tone on the entire East Coast and helped people understand without these giant sharks, our grandchildren are not going to eat fish, and we will not be proud of the planet we leave them. And people understand we need to be looking after these large sharks. She showed us and led us to the birthing site off the southern coast of Long Island in the Montauk region. that we found 2 years ago, building on some science of the past from Jack Casey and Toby Curtis, and went in there and out of nowhere, you know, captured 10 Young of the Year pups. And then we returned earlier this year in August and captured another 10 or so Young of the Year pups and got the 20 size, you know, the sample size of 20, the scientists lead, and we're defining the nursery of the white shark now where they're most vulnerable. So Mary Lee has done so much, right, that it feels difficult to ask any more from her. I think we may or may not hear from her, but it is a pivot point for the Northwest great white shark. She certainly was the key figure in that has ignited an understanding and of how important these animals are and shifted that conversation away from Jaws, right? She has undone everything that Jaws did on the East Coast.
Well, I hope we hear from her again. You know, up until last year's tagging of Montauk and Hudson, Montauk being a 50-pound female, Hudson being a 67-pound male, we didn't have any data. I mean, this is so significant. We didn't know anything about a great white pup and what they do after they're born. What have we learned in the last 2 years?
Well, I think in other parts of the world, they certainly have found some pups and have defined how they move, right? These are all regional puzzles. And you're talking about the Northwest Atlantic white shark puzzle. Mary Lee led us there, and Jack Casey and Toby Curtis, some scientists of the past, had thought that there were young sharks there. And when Mary Lee went there, we decided to invest in an expedition, which is a real risk, right? It's about $500,000 expedition. And we went up there, we did capture 10 Young of the Year white sharks. And what we've learned is that they're living there on the southern coast of Long Island, moving between Montauk all the way right up into the New York Bight and the Jersey coast, back and forth along that southern border of Long Island during the summer into the fall. And we're just seeing now some of our pups starting to head south. Now, when you think about historically, right, this is a puzzle that's an ancient puzzle, hundreds of millions of years old. So a lot of times we try to think in evolutionary time. So when we were there this year in August, what we saw was this tremendous amount of menhaden. Some people call them bunker. It's a bait fish. And we're sitting there, and there's acreage and acreage, and the whales are feeding. The porps are in there. The life is in there thick. And you're sitting there, you're like, of course this is where white sharks drop off their pups. It is the ultimate buffet, right, of a super oily fish. And this is why this is the birthing area and why they're living here the first year of their life. And about November, this time of year, they start to head south. Last year, we tracked the shark south, as far south as South Carolina. And then they moved right back up and spent the summer there again this year. So what we've done is we have defined the movements of the Young of the Year white shark, where they live that first year, the most vulnerable year of their life, where they're most fragile. And we understand now how they're moving from when they're born down in overwinter in the Carolinas and off the Outer Banks in that area, and then back up. So now we have that data set to manage them and manage them through all the various challenges that they face. So an enormous leap forward. A lot of people say things like, oh, there's a lot more white sharks because the seals have come back. The only thing that eats seals in the white shark space are big mature animals. So while that might make them feel a little bit more full while they're mating, if we're not succeeding in the nursery, you don't get an increased number of white sharks. The white sharks aren't back because the seal numbers are increasing. The white sharks are back because something changed in their nursery. And we're no longer killing the baby white sharks. And we are doing some research right now. You know, OSearch is home to Jacksonville University. I have some students working on management changes that occurred back in the 80s and 90s because these animals aren't sexually mature until they're 20. And then the females can only give birth every other year because they have an 18-month gestation period. So what happened was we're seeing a lot of inshore gill nets were removed off the eastern seaboard back in the late 80s and 90s. Then lo and behold, 20 years later, we start to see more big mature sharks off Cape Cod. Yes, there's more seals, so they're coming into the beach and they're happier. Maybe they succeed at a little greater rate at mating because they're well-fed. But the single biggest change that we believe is increasing the population of white sharks on both the East and West Coast has been the elimination of a lot of inshore gill netting, which allows these baby white sharks to succeed and become big mature white sharks and then keep the ocean in balance.
So going back to a couple of things that you have already said, Chris, for our listeners who aren't familiar with your boat, when you talk about going, you know, how Mary Lee led you to the birthing ground near Long Island, and you captured these pups, these great white pups. Talk about what capture means and talk about the process of tagging the sharks on your boat.
Well, the real transformational thing that happened in white shark research was back in 2007 when we took our ship to Guadalupe Island. The ship has a special lift that goes over the side, which allows us to then go out in a small boat, capture these large animals, swing them over the lift, much like you swing a skier into the beach, mm-hmm. and then pick them up out of the water for 15 minutes, put hoses in their mouths so they can breathe. And then we get a big collaborative team of scientists, and we do 15 research projects in 15 minutes, and then we lower them, let them go. Everyone tracks them, right? But there's a lot of other things going on. There's blood work going on mm-hmm. for overall health, stress, and reproductive studies. There's isotope studies for diets. There's ultrasounds. There's a lot of stuff going on. We believe we need maximum collaborative teams around every animal to maximize the leap forward, because our single biggest challenge in being proud of the planet we leave our grandchildren is data and time. And so we have no more time for individual science approaches. We got to break down these barriers between scientists, collaborate and open source to maximize the rate at which we learn what has never been learned before. And so with the ship, we could force collaboration, because in the science space, they're all siloed, and many times they don't collaborate because they're trying to publish or perish. It's the system who shaped them. It's not the individuals, right? So one of the things at OSearch we're trying to do is completely disrupt the way in which we learn on the ocean by forcing big collaborative multidiscipline teams to stand around every animal we capture so we can learn what's never been learned before at a rate that's never been achieved. And so that is the lift allowed us to do that, that's on the ship. So when these sharks come into the lift, we'll have 8 to 10 scientists around them doing everything they do, then we lower them and let them go. And that was the transformational breakthrough, because the scientists were never able to capture a 4,000-pound animal, study it, and let it go alive. They were only able to study the odd dead one, mm-hmm. which then can't lead you to where it gives birth, right? You can't learn much from a dead one. You can learn about the anatomy of the animal, but you can't really learn about its life history. So the lift in the ship has been powerful on many levels, not only exploding the data set around the life history puzzle of white sharks, but also allowing us to disrupt the way in which we learn on the ocean, force collaboration, speed the rate of data creation and learning so we can then manage sooner. Then you move into the open sourcing component of OSearch, where everyone is in the project in real time. So it doesn't matter if you do great science and you publish it and no one knows about it and no one reads it, because ultimately you want to drive policy, right? We want to manage toward abundance. So by allowing the world into the project in real time, by open sourcing on the Global Shark Tracker and our other science, everyone understands what's going on. And then when all of our papers publish, we can move immediately to policy. So we can get 15 things done, open source it to the public, educate at the same time, publish in 7 years and go right to policy. Or you can have individuals working in silos. It might take them 15 years to do one thing and then go to policy. So it's 30 times more efficient. That lift on the ship is more than just a symbol that allowed us to catch big sharks. It has allowed us to disrupt the old way and create a new way that will allow us to learn what we need to learn before it's too late.
Yeah. Now, when you talk about before it's too late and you talk about maintaining the balance, the equilibrium in the ocean so that our grandchildren will be able to eat fish, talk us through that. Why does the disruption on the health of white sharks and tiger sharks that you're studying, why is it so crucial to the supply of fish?
Sure. Well, I think because we're all from the American West and we're not far from Yellowstone. I think anyone who's seen the video on the reintroduction of the wolf into Yellowstone understood what happens when you have a healthy apex predator population and how it completely transforms the entire system. It's called a trophic cascade. Mm-hmm. And so the white sharks are the wolves of the ocean. I encourage everyone to watch that wolf film and just realize the white shark is the wolf. These white sharks are the apex predator and balance keeper. They prevent the second tier predators from exploding in numbers and wiping out the food chain below them. They also modify the behavior of the second-tier predators so they can't just go out and feed at their leisure and wipe out the food chain below them. So the fact is, if we don't have a thriving population of large white sharks, there will be no fish for our children to eat. The squid will explode in the open ocean and migrate to the surface every night and wipe out all the baby tuna, all the baby mahi, all the baby snapper, all the stuff we need to grow up to eat. In the inshore areas, if the sharks aren't thriving, things like rays and other things will explode, wipe out the shellfish. No scallops or oysters for us. No clams, right? Mm-hmm. So it's all connected. And the healthy population of the apex predator is what allows you to manage the system toward its maximum abundance or maximum carrying capacity. So understanding where and when they mate, where and when they give birth, and how they move is the data set, the fundamental cortisone of data that we need to manage toward abundance. And that's why when I found out we didn't have this data set in 2007, and I really, it's understandable that a scientist and his intern are not going to capture a 4,000-pound white shark and solve its life history puzzle. You need some salty people for that. You need some real capacity for that. You need a ship with a lift, and you need money. And so I really, when I look at OSearch, to me, it's social entrepreneurship at its finest. I mean, what we're trying to do is build enterprises that make it worth it for companies to fund the abundant future in the era of brand-integrated content and total connectivity.
If you are just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with Chris Fisher, founder, chairman, expedition leader for OSearch. Chris, OSearch has just conducted its 30th expedition. What's the significance of hitting 22?
For me, I think it was a big sigh of relief. You know, this was a big dream of mine when it started. I never believed it would become what it's become. And I wanted to chase a global impact. I wanted to try to create a global ocean movement, right? It wasn't something... I wanted to try to build something and give it away to the future so that it could serve the future forever. And Cousteau led 22 expeditions. And at that time, the noble goal was to pour the world's oceans into people's lives at a scale unseen since Cousteau. And I was like, well, maybe if we can hold it together for 22 expeditions like Cousteau did, we have a shot at that. And the fact that we've now completed 30 expeditions and we have three more planned for next year is something I could have never dreamed would occur. And it's actually allowed me to relax a little bit. I kind of look back and feel bad of how hard I drove a lot of people and how hard I pushed the ball up the hill trying to get to that mark. And I think once we got past that mark, I was actually able to take a deep breath and realize what we were doing and enjoy it and see it. Because it's very stressful work, right? You're trying to get 25 people through a 25-day trip, keep everyone alive, keep the ship in a safe place, keep the sharks alive. And, you know, you have to go into a place of focus when you're doing that. And to get past that, I was able to relax and enjoy it a bit more.
You have a very unique business model, the gist of it being give everything away, monetize the scale, not the product. Let's talk about this.
Yeah,
this,
so it's, I think it would
this
be unique
model.
I don't think it's unique anymore. It's nothing but Google.
It's
or
unique,
Twitter.
Yeah,
it is unique in the science space. It is unique in this space. But look at how much more inclusion and capacity we've been able to create from that. So the idea is, look, if we want to be proud of the planet, we're going to leave our kids. And I think most anyone would buy into that, right? So for the purpose of this conversation, there is no you and me. There is just us. And what are we going to do, right? So therefore, you got to have inclusion as one of your core values. We need to get everybody included, right?
How so do we do that?
We give it away.
That's
right.
It.
We give everything away. We give the data away. We give the content away. We push it all in the now. Everyone's in the now across all the OSearch handles, OSearch Twitter, OSearch Instagram, OSearch Facebook. All the sharks have their own handles. And so we give everything away. We create radical scale. And in all that content that we give away, we integrate the brands that fund our work. Costa Sunglasses has been supporting us for a decade. You can buy Costa Sunglasses and fund OSearch. They have a co-branded line. Yeti Coolers, SeaWorld, Southern Tide, Caterpillar, pick a brand. All of these brands we integrate into the content, we give the content away, and we resonate. We have over 1.6 billion hard impressions a year through about 5,000 news stories on OSearch a year. And that creates value for these companies. So the real puzzle was, from a social entrepreneurship standpoint, how can we build enterprises that drive so much scale in a blue chip with blue chip substance about creating an abundant future for our children that it makes it worth it for sustainably oriented companies to fund it? Because they have the scale and capacity. Think about if we could harness the scale of every company and part of their mission was to create an abundant future. That is how we're going to do it. Now, there's a few rich guys out there who are going to help. But if we really want to get it done for our children, we got to make it worth it for the companies to do it because they have all the scale and capacity. They have to market every year. And they'd want to resonate with the millennial and younger. And the way to do that is to do something real for the future, give it away, and ask for nothing.
You've got a big boat. You've got a big crew. You wouldn't be able to do what you did unless you could monetize the scale.
Absolutely. I mean, it cost us about $2 million a year to give away 3 expeditions to the scientists. And I think a lot of people don't understand that. The OSEARCH, the ship, moves into a region. We have 24 institutions in the Northwest Atlantic on the Northwest Atlantic White Shark team. And we come in with the ship. We give them the ship. We give the scientists the ship because they have no capacity. They have no boats. And it's the companies that fund the ship that allow us to travel around the world and give it away. And what that does is that allows us to force collaboration, force open sourcing, and just put the ocean and our grandchildren first.
Let's go to the sharks. Okay. From the time we last spoke to you, which was, I think, last year sometime, I loaded your shark tracker on my little iPhone here. And, you know, I'll be sitting in an airport. My flight's late. There are all these people around me. I pull up my shark tracker and just see what's happening out there. And the thing that fascinates me is that some sharks seem to have a little ADHD. They are going everywhere all the time, back and forth and, you know, crossing back over their path. And others will go head straight out into the Atlantic from the Eastern Seaboard in the straight line. And you go, where were they going? What were they going for? So let's talk about the shark that has most recently surfaced, which is Savannah.
Okay.
She's a cute little thing. She's about 460 pounds. She's immature, so she's like the tweener. Is that what you said?
That's right.
And she surfaced just a few hours ago. Let's see, was it off?
She's southbound off Nova Scotia.
Right, right. Okay, and now she does a little bit of this zigzagging around all over, and then she hightails it down to South Carolina, I would imagine, for the winter. But talk about this, the personalities of the sharks. Why do some, you know, zigzag all over and others go straight for something like they have got this goal in mind?
Sure. I think, well, one thing we've learned from the tracking we didn't understand is these animals have an amazing capacity to navigate in a very accurate internal calendar, which I think is synced up with the moon. So when you see a shark zigzagging around in an area, it's moved into that area. It's foraging if it's an immature animal, right? Or a mature animal and it's not mating season. When they decide to move, they move in a very deliberate direction, and they move in a very timely manner. So when you see these sharks zigzagging around, it's likely they found a region they like. They're going to be there for a while. They're a bit foraging around. When they decide to move, like you said, boom, they'll straight line at 2,000 miles and go from one spot to another. And they'll repeat that, right? There is no randomness in the ocean. I think everyone needs to understand that these sharks have game trails just like we have through the forest, and they are using those same trails moving back and forth every year or every other year if it's a big mature female. So you really need to think about the ocean like the forest. I know a lot of people don't do that, but there are game trails. There are places where things go to mate. There are places where they go to feed, and they do that over and over again, and they have the same routine. I think there's a couple of interesting sharks right now. Savannah's certainly one of them. She's kind of revealing that tweener life of the North Atlantic White Shark Forest. We're starting to get a handle on the young of the year. We're starting to get a handle on the mature animals. But what about the tweener? That's where Savannah is hugely important. We tagged her last spring off of Hilton Head. She went to Nova Scotia. Now she's heading back. Is that just the expanding range of the young of the year as they get older and older? Does that range go from, instead of Montauk to South Carolina, does it expand to Nova Scotia down into Florida? And she's a little older, so is her kind of range expanding?
Mm-hmm.
I think one of the most interesting sharks to watch on the tracker right now is Hilton. I believe Hilton is identifying a secondary mating site, which I believe is in Nova Scotia. We're trying to get permits to go to Canada next year. We're wondering if we're going to see the same thing we found in the Pacific with mating at Guadalupe and mating at the Farallon Islands. Excellent evolutionary strategy to have two mating sites and make it 400 million years. If one gets wiped out, the other one can reseed the population. We also found two birthing sites in the Pacific. Will we find another birthing site in the Northwest Atlantic beyond the Montauk region? Hilton is a key toward finding that, and I believe Hilton and the shark Lydia have shown us a secondary mating area off Nova Scotia. It'll be interesting to see if we can get a female white shark there, and where might she take us to give birth, much like Mary Lee took us from Cape Cod to the Montauk region. So there's a lot of excitement. We are going to win. We are going to win. We are going to solve this puzzle, and we are going to leverage the data, and the East Coast is going to be abundant. I think that's the energy I try to bring into this space, in the nonprofit space. There's no sky is falling story. We are operating with a sense of urgency, and we expect to win. It's not like, oh, can you give me your money? It's worse now than it was last year, and then I'm going to call you and say, oh, it's worse now again. Send me more. No, we're going to win.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
We only have about a minute left, but I wanted to ask you, I was really surprised when we met last year and you told me that 100 million sharks are destroyed every year on this planet. In 30 seconds, 45 seconds, tell us about your quest to get shark fin soup off the menu.
Yeah, so we're going to win this one too. The demand for shark fin soup is down about 40% over the last 3 years. Great groups like WildAid impacting that in China. We're developing the data to speed recovery. So as the demand for shark fin soup goes down, with the data around the nursery and birthing and mating, we can help manage toward abundance quicker.
Chris Fisher, founder, chairman, expedition leader for OSearch. Thanks so much for joining us this morning on Cool Science Radio.
Pleasure. Have me anytime.
We'd love to have you back.
Thanks,
we
Chris.
We shall return. We're going to have a conversation with Dr. Mitch Goldberg, chief scientist for the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration's Joint Polar Satellite System. Stay with us.
Hi, I'm Courtney Johansson, owner of 350 Main Brasserie, and we are pleased to support KPCW. 350 Main is located in the historic Golden Rule Building at 350 Main Street and serves eclectic American cuisine. Open nightly at 5:30 p.m. Reservations, menu, and contact information at 350main.com.
This is Tom Roney with Berkshire Hathaway Home Services Utah Properties. We are committed to serving Park City and are proud supporters of KPCW. More information at bhhsutah.com or one of our 24 offices throughout Summit and Wasatch counties.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peak, here with John Wells. We were just speaking with OSearch founding chairman Chris Fisher. What energy.
Yeah.
And what accomplishment. That guy's going huge places, but fascinating. And, you know, we didn't mention it, but he's also a Park City resident.
He is.
In between his 3 25-day trips, expeditions per year, all the fundraising he does, the speaking around the country, he comes back here to Park City to lead a mountain lifestyle.
That's right.
You got to have balance in your life, right? So our next guest is Dr. Mitch Goldberg, the chief scientist for NOAA's Joint Polar Satellite System. Circling the Earth 13 times per day, this new satellite with capture data about the planet's atmosphere, land, and oceans. This data will be used to support a broad range of applications, including weather analysis and forecasting, climate research and prediction, global sea surface temperature measurements, atmospheric soundings of temperature and humidity, ocean dynamics research, volcanic eruption monitoring. Boy, the list goes on. The satellite is scheduled to launch Tuesday, this coming Tuesday, November 14th. Dr. Mitch Goldberg, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. So upon the launch this coming Tuesday of the Joint Polar Satellite System, and you all just call it by its acronym, is that right?
Yeah, JPSS.
Okay, the JPSS. So what does it bring that has not yet been there before in terms of predicting weather or in terms of the trajectory of a satellite?
Well, you know, this is a polar orbiting satellite, so it's orbiting from pole to pole, about 512 miles in altitude. And as it's orbiting from pole to pole, you know, south pole to north pole, the Earth is rotating underneath it. So that's how we get global observation. So what it's bringing is, it's bringing the most critical data that is used in weather forecast models, so we can forecast weather accurately up to 7 days. So it collects information on atmospheric temperature and water vapor. And the difference of this satellite is that it's actually it's an operational satellite. And so there's been research satellites in the past. NASA flew research satellites with this type of capability that has also been used in weather forecast models. And what we're doing now is operationalize it. operationalizing this. So this is a series of four satellites. JPSS-1, which will be launched in this Tuesday, will be called NOAA 20. Then about every 5 years, we'll launch another one. And so, again, this is really the most critical data that's used in weather forecast models. And the program is bringing continuity, operational reliability for this type of data for the next 20 years.
So I guess I was a little surprised, and I wondered if it was just my own conjuring about where I thought the trajectory of a weather satellite went. I suppose I always thought they went latitudinally around the Earth that way. But when you see the trajectory of these satellites that will be, as you say, North Pole, South Pole, around the world, 14 times a day. Boy, it's just incredible. And it makes you realize, well, of course, because you have to know what's going on near each of the poles. What does it tell us near each of the poles that, you know, predicts what's going to happen down here at 45 degrees north latitude, for example?
Yeah, well, it does observe, you know, it does observe the poles very well, because we do have 14 orbits per day, and they all overlap near the poles. But it's really the global observations, you know, even at the equator. And so what it's doing is it's just orbiting in a circle. You can imagine the circle being constant from South Pole to North Pole, but it's still passing over the equator and so forth and all parts of the world. And as the Earth is moving or rotating underneath it, we're getting global data. So, for example, we're observing, for example, let's say there's a typhoon out, you know, off the coast of Japan. That weather, that severe weather event can impact our weather like 3 to 5 days later over the western U.S., bringing in like, you know, atmospheric rivers, causing a lot of rain in California and so forth. And so we have to observe that event and in off of Asia in order to feed that information into weather models, so then weather models can predict that event, you know, 3 to 7 days later. And so it's not... it's just not pole observations, it's global observations. But we do see the poles really, really well. And people up, you know, people living up in Alaska, they depend on this type of data for actually real-time weather.
Dr. Goldberg, we had somebody on from Raven recently. It's a technology that they're testing up in space currently. And it's for eventually to be able to provide autonomous satellite repair capability, sort of robotic repair. Is this new satellite capable of being repaired by robots? Because you have to do certain things.
No, this satellite, we can't repair the satellite in space. This is why it probably has to do a combination of altitude and also the engineering. It's an interesting concept. You're probably referring to more to communication satellites, which is very different. Mm-hmm. For repairing those satellites. But these satellites are very complex. They have a lot of different instrumentations. They're measuring all parts of the spectrum in terms of, like the microwave and the visible near-infrared, the UV, and so forth. So they're very complex. So you wouldn't be able to repair these instruments in space. And so this is why we fly a series of them. Each one has a 7-year design life, and then we launch them periodically about every 5 years. To make sure we have good coverage globally.
Okay. And there's a lot of stuff up there that's circling our planet right now.
Mm-hmm.
Do you license a particular flight path to ensure that other people don't put things up there you could potentially bump into? Or how is that managed, if at all?
I think it is managed. We pick a particular orbit. You know, space is pretty big. You know, so you can have two satellites 5 minutes apart in terms of each orbit is like a, you know, it's like a racetrack. Each orbit takes about 101 minutes. So you can imagine a car or, you know, going around a racetrack. And you can have satellites 5 minutes apart and they're not going to collide with each other. It just doesn't happen. But it is managed. I think, there's databases of where our satellites are going to be launched. This is a particular orbit that is mostly used by weather satellites. And again, space is pretty big, so I don't think we have to worry about those things.
Now, when I'm out on the interstate cruising along and I see a wide load ahead, inevitably it's always like a trailer house or something like that. I never see a satellite trucking from Boulder, Colorado, out to California to the Vandenberg Air Force Base as these satellites were done. So that would be amazing to just see a satellite cruising along on the back of the truck. Talk about the transport.
Well, it is transported by truck, but we don't put a label and say, hey, an expensive satellite is here, come get me. so you'll never know it. You know, we try not to,
clandestine.
We put it in a regular truck that just travels across the country. There's a lot of people, you know, other vehicles by the truck, making sure if something happens, if something happens with the truck, we make sure it's repaired and all that stuff. So, but we don't advertise it.
Yeah, so it's small enough to fit inside a truck. So.
Yeah, absolutely.
So talk about the facility in Boulder, Colorado, where it was built. And is it built completely there and tested before it trucks out to California?
Yeah, so it's all assembled in Colorado. But the instruments are coming from different vendors. So, you know, one instrument is built in California. A couple of instruments are built in California by Raytheon and Northrop Grumman. And then Ball, the spacecraft is coming from Ball, from Colorado. They also build one of the instruments called OMPS, which is an ozone sounder. And so all of them are tested at the different locations where they're being built. And then they're assembled, they're connected, to the spacecraft. And then they're also tested again. And then it's all assembled, and then it's shipped out to the launch pad.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with Dr. Mitch Goldberg. He is the chief scientist for NOAA's Joint Polar Satellite System. And this system, this is REV-1, and there will be three additional satellites spaced, I believe you said, 5 years apart.
Roughly 5 years. 5 years apart. I think the next one will actually be in 2021, so that's about 4 years.
Right, and those capabilities may change as technology changes, or have you? You probably.
No, we locked in, and so these
in
capabilities.
Already.
So, yeah, and it's fine because they're pretty advanced capabilities, and they're really the right type of information that the forecasters need or the models need. And so they'll be very relevant even in 20 years for a number of factors. First of all, it's providing the detailed temperature and water vapor information globally, so that's still going to be relevant. Also, we provide a lot of data. And so even as models, weather forecast models improve over time, there's always this limiting computer power, in order to digest a lot of data. And so... so they have to take out data, and they thin it a bit in order to allow the right amount of data to get into models, because models have to run in a certain amount of time when you run weather forecast models. But in the future, we're going to have larger computers, and we're going to be able to process more data, and then actually more satellite data will be actually used in the models. So right now, 85% of all data that's used in forecast models come from polar orbiting satellites like JPSS, and we're going to, and the trend will be, likely to continue where more of that data will continue to be used.
Dr. Goldberg is chief scientist for this project. You've put together a pretty sophisticated instrumentation package for this satellite, and I'm sure you're a very curious person. What one question would you like this satellite to be able to answer for you that has not been answered in the past?
Well, first of all, the satellite system is going to, I'll get to the answer to your question, but remember, this satellite is providing critical information for weather models and environmental intelligence. And so, detecting wildfires and things like that, flood mapping and volcanic ash, everything, a lot of information. So the first thing that we would like to provide to the nation is, we're going to provide better quality data in order to improve applications. So what I would like to see happen, and I know this is going to happen, we're just going to have improved services. So we're going to have improved warnings of, let's say, forest fires or the potential of fires. And if there is a fire, we'll be able to observe very quickly and use data from the satellite to predict its movement accurately. So I see that the satellite will support the information or the observations needed to improve services, like the services that impact in terms of the environment that will impact everyone. And because it's a long series, the next 20 years and beyond, it will take accurate measurements of how, for example, how our climate is changing. So we'll see changes in sea ice, for example, from year to year. It can increase, it can decrease. And these type of changes are important because you have to be able to predict them. And also, there's always... for example, if there's less sea ice, there's going to be more navigation, shipping up there, the Northwest Passage and over the Arctic. And then we have to observe constantly in order to help provide information for navigation and other applications.
Dr. Goldberg, I'm wondering about the environmental intelligence and the ability to do more climate prediction. It seems now, and I'm thinking about, I don't know if you've seen the documentary Chasing Ice, but most of the prediction is, or most of the tracking of climate change is done by film from the land, right? So you can track how far, how quickly a glacier or an ice cap is receding. But there must be some intermediate stage that is more high-tech than that that's being currently used. Can you describe what's being currently used versus what this technology will enable us to do?
Well, yeah. So I think most of the changes documented by, I would say, also by satellites, right? Because satellites have the global perspective. Mm-hmm. And so we have, we have very accurate instruments that will observe the globe. So, for example, everything that you can imagine that, a changing climate would result in, let's say, temperature change. Okay. Mm-hmm. So we have very accurate instruments that provide temperature information to weather forecast models. But at the same time, we're going to have a long data record of temperature that then you can look at, well, how has the temperature changed for the next 20 years? So we'll be able to see that. And also every variable, like, for example, we can monitor the health of vegetation. And so we would be able to look at trends in the health of vegetation over time. Are there more droughts, less droughts, things like that. And also sea surface temperature. We observe sea surface temperature. So we can actually see how the temperature is changing over time. So I think if you think about nearly all the key variables that people look when they think about a changing climate, we'll be able to observe that as well. Because those type of variables are the same variables that you need for weather forecast models. And so it's sort of almost practically the same data. And so when you climate is simply, it's like 30-year average of weather. It's an average, basically. And you're saying, well, is this average changing over time? Is this 30-year running mean changing over time? And so we'll have the data to answer those questions.
Yeah. Wow. Fascinating. We have spoken a handful of times to Dalia Kirschbaum from NASA, who talks about the global precipitation measurement, which does a CT scan of extreme weather events. How does the technology differ between what you're doing with the Joint Polar Satellite System and the GPM?
Well, GPM has like a radar system where it actually gives you more detailed information of the vertical profile of precipitation. That gives you very good detailed information. But GPM is also a constellation. It's the Global Mission Constellation. And so it's a constellation of, the GPM technology, the radar. But it's also a constellation includes passive microwave observation, which basically we're measuring, the emission of radiation coming from the Earth in the microwave, which is sensitive to precipitation. So if you have, precipitation, which means that the microwave that we're seeing from the instrument is the radiation is scattered, and that's a signal, which means that we have precipitation. And so so that we're part of that constellation. So we provide very good precipitation measurements from, you know, from our satellite, rain rates, things like that, even snow rates. But it's more of a, it's more of an integrated quantity. And so it's, so it's almost like radar. When you look at radar, you look at the rate, like weather radar, you look at the intensity of the precipitation, but you don't really have the vertical structure. Maybe you do, but we don't see it. And so, I mean, it's not, we don't see it on television, things like that. So we're mostly two-dimensional when it comes to precipitation. We have a little bit vertical information, but it's mostly you're looking straight down and you're looking at rain intensity. So, yeah, you know, GPM is a very important mission, and we are part of that constellation as well. And also we have a very large swath. So GPM is very good in vertical, but then the swath, which means how much real estate I can cover in a day, is less than what we have. So we can cover the entire globe twice per day easily, you know, without precipitation measurements, and GPM will take a little bit longer. But we use all data sets together. For example, you know, we have different satellites. We have geostationary, we have polar satellites, and GPM. And so when we have services, for example, let's say NOAA has a service that tries to give us the best global precipitation estimates. We'll use data sets from all different satellites and all, and also conventional radar, and we integrate that all together. And so, so it is an integrated observing system, and JPSS is a critical part of that observing system.
The JPSS, Joint Polar Satellite, will be launching on Tuesday the 14th. It will be 8:15 in the morning. Excuse me, it'll be 6:15 in the morning Mountain Time, and you can grab that as the Delta II rocket lifts off. You can grab that by going to nasa.gov, and there will be a video feed there that you can actually watch the launch.
Let me correct you. It's 1:47 a.m. Pacific time.
1:47 Pacific. Oh, okay.
Yeah, and we also have a NOAA, at NOAA Satellites is our Twitter feed.
Uh-huh.
So all the latest information about the launch can be is provided at that feed, and there's also links to the program as well at NOAA Satellites.
Right. And do you expect that, that launch time to hold? I know that the launch was originally scheduled for tomorrow morning.
Yeah, it should hold. There was an issue with some battery that actually the battery they tested this battery, but the battery's not part of the payload. It's actually a battery to detonate the rocket if something bad happens, like if the rocket goes off course, and you have to safeguard. And so that battery, so it had nothing to do with the mission. It's just the battery of the self-destruct was too weak. And so they have to ship a new battery from Kennedy Space Center. And so it takes time. You know, it's in the deep freezer, and they have to, you know, warm it up and things like that. So so when you count the number of days, that's why I went from Friday morning to Tuesday.
Okay.
It's the time to get that battery.
So snail mail.
Terrible, but those things happen.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Now, so we expect the battery will be in place. Everything is a go for Tuesday morning. Of course, things happen. Like, for example, let's say you have really strong winds aloft, you know, that you can't control. You don't want to launch a rocket when it's too windy. And so there's certain things that we just have to, go by. You know, if it turns out the weather's lousy, then we'll have to do it the next day. But we're expecting a launch Tuesday morning, so I hope it happens.
Yeah, and the Joint Polar Satellite, when it is launched, how long until you get through shakedown and it starts providing data? And when it starts providing data, will it be communicating with GPM or other satellites up there?
No, it won't be communicating with different satellites. It will be processed on its own. But it takes about 90 days. So we have Launch Plus 90, where the data, most of the data will be tested, the critical data that goes into weather forecast models. So that data should be flowing. And then we have a lot of different products that has to be validated fully. So the availability of those data sets will, is a function of the different type of products. And, go ahead.
Oh, no, sorry to interrupt. The Joint Polar Satellite System will be launching again on Tuesday, November 14th from Vandenberg Air Force Base. Now, that's just south of the San Luis Obispo area. Is that right?
Yes, yes. I'm actually here in a hotel outside the base.
Nice. Well, it's always beautiful in California, so I'm sure the
let me look outside. Yep. Oh, I'm looking outside now. My hotel window. I see the mountains. Beautiful, clear skies. I think it's going to be almost 70 degrees today. So,
Yes,
it is a nice place. It's a beautiful place to launch a rocket, for sure.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. Well, it's been a pleasure talking with you. Good luck with the launch. Our guest is Dr. Mitch Goldberg, and thank you for being our guest on Cool Science Radio.
Again, thank you for having me on. It was really cool to be on Cool Science Radio. Thank you so much.
That's great. All right.
Have a great day.
You too.
You too.
And when we return, we'll talk a little bit about giving some love to KPCW, and that's tomorrow. Live PC, give PC. Stay with us.
Spend the day and cover billions of years at the Natural History Museum of Utah. The museum offers innovative exhibits and hands-on experiences. Native voices explore the traditions of Utah's native peoples. The Great Salt Lake Gallery tells the story of the largest saltwater lake in the Western Hemisphere. The Past Worlds exhibit includes more than a dozen new species of dinosaurs discovered right here in Utah. Visit nhmu.utah.edu. The Natural History Museum of Utah is a nonprofit organization and a KPCW supporter.
Hi, I'm Tom Pettigrew from Park City Mountain and a proud supporter of KPCW. Park City Mountain instructors share their love of skiing and snowboarding with guests, helping them improve their skills and enjoy the mountain. More information on Ski and Snowboard School and other programs at parkcitymountain.com.
Thanks for tuning in to Cool Science Radio. Great guest today.
Yeah.
Chris Fisher. It's really hard to keep up with the energy of that guy.
Yeah, and the one thing we didn't have time to talk about was the K-8 STEM, science, technology, engineering, and mathematics courseware that they have developed that they provide free to any teacher that wants to download it, that will be able to take the tracking data from the sharks and be able to connect that to math.
I hope all the kids in the Park City School District, being that Chris Fisher is a local resident, I hope they're all tracking great white sharks.
Well, I know we are, Lynn.
We are. I love tracking those things. Hey, tomorrow is Park City's Day of Giving, November 10th, and we hope that you'll show KPCW your love with a donation. I mean, you know, if you listen to the Public Affairs Hour here on KPCW every weekday from 9 to 10, we've got all kinds of great information. Experts from all around the globe literally joining us to share their expertise and make us all a little smarter and a little more, in this case, science curious.
Yeah, that's right. So just ask yourself the value that you think KPCW provides for you, be it the tremendous local news crack team we have, or the eclectic DJs playing all sorts of cool music, Randy Barton in the afternoon, the public affairs shows, as you just mentioned. And if you feel good about it, go to kpcw.org or to Live PC, Give PC, and give generously.
Yeah, you know, we've got a great goal, and we're always trying to get up on that leaderboard. We're a little bit competitive, you know, and we love to see KPCW up there. So you can start giving now. You can start giving at midnight. You can start giving in the morning. But give often tomorrow during Live PC, Give PC, and keep KPCW in mind. I mean, this is a day about all of the nonprofits that you love in this town. But keep in mind that we at KPCW support those nonprofits every single day of the year, getting the word out about what they're doing. If it weren't for KPCW, you probably wouldn't be nearly as connected to this community and all the great work of the nonprofits in this town.
While you're on kpcw.org, why don't you just click on the music crawl and pick up a couple tickets? It's November 18th, bands, three venues.
That's right, another party. San Francisco Design, Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties, Peak Art and Frame, Nexus IT, the Natural History Museum of Utah, and Park City Mountain, all our underwriters. It's KPCW Park City.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided in part by AMA Waterways and Park City Air Cruise and Travel, 565-4730, parkcityaircruiseandtravel.com. Long Reimer Weiniger Bepler, Estate Planning,